Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this April the 14th on the West Coast, now April the 15th on the East Coast and in the Central time zones. Then we have the issues of the earthquakes, tsunamis, and destruction in various parts of the planet, not just in Japan. Tonight's guest has been studying this for some years, written about it. His work is featured on Ken Adachi's website, educate-yourself.org. He is an essayist, an intuitive, a metaphysician, and a thinker. He's a truth seeker, and he does find the truth. He's becoming a regular here on Evident Footprints, all the way from Canada, my good friend, Zora Nova Star Livingstone. Z.S., welcome to the show. How are you?
It's great to be here.
Okay, now I got to make sure you speak up here, because we want everybody to hear every word you have to say.
Okay.
So make sure you speak up.
Okay.
You wrote a piece within the last couple of days about Japan, and we're getting mixed messages from everywhere, even from Japan, I have to say. There are some videos out that are showing some of the devastation of the tsunami, and then we're seeing people leaving areas in the neighborhood of the nuclear power plant. There's too much radiation around there. What's your take on what's going on, ZS, if you don't mind summarizing it?
Okay. Well, right from the very start, I knew there was a false flag that the explosion of the four reactors, especially at number three, when a mushroom cloud rose over top of it, immediately knew that that was a tactical nuke or a suitcase nuke, that not a hydrogen explosion. And so I was continually looking at pictures of the explosion and seeing all this twisted metal, the roof blown off, and they're talking about keeping the water levels high in the holding tanks for the fuel rods that are withdrawn from the reactor. And the fuel rods were supposedly automatically all withdrawn from the reactor at the time of the 9.0 earthquake on March 11th, and would have been drawn into the holding tank, or pulled up into the holding tank and cooled down there. And it takes quite about over a week, maybe 2 weeks, for it to cool down, as the fission products of cerium and iodine are intermittent steps in the heat process of the breakdown of the uranium. And so we're getting all this information about they're having to keep the water levels high, or else the zirconium alloy tubes would melt, and you have a meltdown. And they're saying that it looks like we have the tubes are melting down, and there'll be problems. Well, last week I saw a picture, probably taken by a helicopter, looking through the gap in the roof directly into that holding tank where there's no water.
Mm-hmm.
The water had long since disappeared because it was a crack in the foundations, and it was going down to the earth and possibly into the sea. And they just they kept putting water in there, and they were actually putting seawater in there to cool the rods. But then looking down, we're seeing this crane had cracked with the explosion, had crashed down on top of the what they call the cans, or it's actually a square grid rack. And I looked at the rack, and there were no fuel rods. The place where the fuel rods were supposed to be, and where often, especially in American reactors, where they have old fuel rods in storage for years after the useful lifetime of uranium is gone, would be layers upon layers of these thin 1 to 2 inch diameter rods, up to 20 feet long, depending on the size of the reactor, hanging from that grid. It wasn't there.
Okay, now, let's back up for a minute. You described seeing twisted metal. Now, was that the metal of the roof itself?
Yeah, it was metal of the roof. The support gantries for the crane, which would be on rails in the ceiling there, it would go move back and forth like a crane in the steel mill, which would lift girders up and then haul them from one side of the plant to another side of the plant, or that crane would have full access for the whole tank, the whole grid.
Now the crane was outside then, you're saying?
No, it was in near the roof.
Near the roof, okay.
On the inside of the containment building.
Okay. So you had a clear view of missing fuel rods, is what you're saying?
Right. And if the fuel rods had stayed in the reactor and the electricity had gone out, well, it's an impossible situation. You would have had a meltdown. No water in the core.
In the reactor core, you're saying.
In the reactor core, or no water in the storage core. The heat would have built up in a matter of days, and the tubes would have turned into spaghetti, like cooked spaghetti, melting together into a mass. If they were in the racks, they would have melted the racks. The racks were not melted. They're pretty well intact, even in spite of the explosion. They're very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And
the earthquake, or and the earthquake,
yeah, it was shaking for like 10 minutes, and it was the building was intact after the 9.0 earthquake. Maybe the foundations were cracked, or the grid was pretty well there. Mm-hmm. Then the explosion. Fragmented the roof and blew the crane down upon the racks, mm-hmm. or the cans.
Yeah, I looked at a few photographs of the site from a distance, photographed from the distance. I was close to the photograph, but, you know, I looked at what was a long shot of the whole facility, and it appeared to me that you could take that photograph and put that on a postcard and send it to somebody and they wouldn't think anything of it. You know, you couldn't see a lot of damage from the front end of the building. So I concur with you on that. Now, I think on one or two of our past shows where you and I and Ken Adachi spoke about this, we talked about the fact that, there were news reports that they were bringing light water into the area so that they could hand that over to the Japanese, and they were going to add that to the reactor core to prevent a meltdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was coming from Ronald Reagan?
Well, CNN, Fox, you know, the mainstream fair and balanced networks out there. what I found interesting is that after they said that, you had this this impression in your mind that they were going to be shipping water possibly in containers. And what we saw when the images actually were shown of this event was the helicopter, and I referred to that it was dropping water and it was spraying all over the place, sort of right. Like when they dump water on a wildfire in Southern California.
Yeah,
it looked just like that. And it wasn't a real large helicopter either. So whatever was going on, I thought was probably just for visual effect.
Okay.
And I don't know if you saw that or how that even resonates.
I think I saw that picture, and I saw that they missed the building by half the water.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a possibility that water did come from the aircraft carrier Ronald Reagan, and it was like water, but it came from their reactors and was radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what they call light water is regular water, H2O, purified. So it's very, very clear.
Mm-hmm.
And but what they call heavy water is deuterium water. And in Canada here, our nuclear reactors are called heavy water reactors. And that if you put heavy water into storage tanks, it would cause the it become a neutron slowing medium and would cause the nuclear chain reaction to happen inside the holding tank and mm-hmm. not in the General Electric and most American reactors. The moderating unit is carbon blocks, and the carbon blocks slows the neutrons to allow the fission reaction to go ahead and creating a sustainable chain reaction, creating a release of a sustainable release of energy.
Mm-hmm. Now, and, you mentioned the Ronald Reagan. Do you think that they routinely carry light water around with them?
Well, they'd have to for their nuclear reactors, but they wouldn't be, they wouldn't have a huge amount like the huge tank there. They'd have to have their own storage facilities for their spent their rods when they're pulled out of the reactor core,
mm-hmm.
and they'd have to have a light water source there, plus excess or extra tanks of light water, purified water.
Well, it just seems awful suspicious to me that this would have been so easy for them to do. They seem to have arrived there rather quickly.
Yeah, on the hand.
When they want to start a war like they did the first Gulf War, it took a month to get all the ships in place and start the whole plan into motion. And here you have this supposedly or allegedly natural event, as they would like us to believe, and there is a ship right there ready to help out. Now, I'm not saying that that couldn't happen accidentally or coincidentally, but it seems very scripted to me.
And the ship would normally be based Okinawa and south.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be up on that coast very often.
Yeah, I wonder if they could even get there that fast. It seemed like it was the next day, didn't it?
Well, they say the aircraft carriers can can outrace their destroyer escorts if they really want to put on the get up to over 40 knots. So if they really wanted to get there fast without the armada around them, they usually travel in convoy,
mm-hmm.
with the destroyer escorts and Aegis class.
Well, would they easily leave their escorts behind?
Oh, easily. They just.
No, what I'm saying is that just a.
It wouldn't be policy. It wouldn't be
a decision to make.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a good decision to make.
Okay, so that's probably unlikely. So,
yeah.
You know, they were pretty much in the proximity of the event, it seems.
Yeah.
Much like some other false flag events that have occurred within the last year out at sea. And I'm speaking about the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes.
And which still stinks.
Oil there.
Yeah. Well, I got to see a video, and I have to tell you, it's difficult to watch, but I watched a Japanese video, some 5 minutes or so, of the tsunami coming in, and from a distance, all you could see in the beginning of the video was a brownish spray that was hovering in the air, and it seemed to be rising higher and higher. And then slowly you could see the waves creeping in. And it was kind of eerie because it was as though the people had no idea this was coming. There was actually a bus driving through an overpass tunnel, and it was moving quickly. I don't know if they were going to gain an access road and swing around and then start heading up to higher ground. It was being filmed from a higher vantage point. And then with only maybe 15 seconds left, some people came out of a few houses there and were just casually walking up the hill as the waves were racing in to basically swallow them up. A few people were swept into the rushing seas, and some were rescued and made it to higher ground. Mm-hmm. But I don't even...
Well, the Japanese are trained on tsunami avoidance, they right from kindergarten on, they're told to go to higher ground, and especially on the coastal areas, they would have their safe areas several hundred feet higher than sea level.
Mm-hmm.
But what's strange about the tsunami is it came in 20 minutes after the end of the 9.0 earthquake, supposedly from an area about 80 miles offshore.
Now, what is significant about that? I kind of know what you're going to say, but I'd like to tell the audience.
What's significant is that seismic ocean waves or tsunamis travel at 600 miles per hour in deep water. They're slower towards the shallow waters. And that means that the actual time from 80 miles out would be less than 10 minutes. Therefore, they were probably thinking after at 10 minutes after the earthquake, they're all clear. So they're just walking around, driving around in the buses, returning back to the shore or back to their homes. And it's very likely that the 9.0 did not cause a tsunami, but one of the smaller earthquakes that followed like clockwork 10 minutes later, then another 10 minutes, and another 10 minutes, the artificial earthquakes around 6 on the Richter scale, one of them was probably a hydrogen bomb in a bathysphere in the subduction trench 80 miles offshore at 10 to 15,000 feet underwater. It's similar to the scenario that Joe Viles writes about on the Indian Ocean tsunami of December 26th, 2004. And he says that was an H-bomb in a bathysphere at the bottom of the trench off the coast of Sumatra.
Mm-hmm.
And it created a steam bubble. The actual reading, the initial reading on the Indonesian seismic was something like 5.8, which would be what you'd expect for an explosion in water. Of course, you got all that the heat would flash the ocean water to steam, create a huge bubble, which would force all the water out in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
And the bubble would rise, possibly breaking the surface 20,000 feet in the... they had to explode it really deep in order to prevent the bubble from appearing at ocean level, but it would have caused the tsunami.
As opposed to, let's say, an explosive impression that one could see at the top of the water, where the water sort of sprays out.
You would see the explosion on the surface of the water.
So
you're saying that, you said it clearly.
you're implying then that there was likely an explosion that occurred. Now,
yes,
what it was that exploded could possibly be debated.
Right. But I don't expect they have a million tons of TNT at the bottom of the ocean. It'd take a lot of aircraft carriers to deposit.
Mm-hmm. Would it be possible from space that a weapon was directed in that area to cause the same effect? Let's say if it was sort of a penetrating beam.
From 4 years looking at seismograms, they've been firing space-based beams like clockwork, especially on that coast there. It was like the pattern which they created all along that coast, 800 earthquakes between 4.7 and 5.5 on the Richter scale. none of them caused tsunamis, and most of them were causing earthquakes at 10 kilometers and 35 kilometers. And there's no changes in the ocean floor. The 9.0 looked like it started off to be an artificial earthquake up to 7 on the Richter scale, but then that artificial earthquake triggered a natural earthquake of pent-up tectonic pressure, creating the 10-minute-long 9.0 earthquake. So it was an artificial earthquake that created a shift and moving the whole island of Japan 8 miles towards Asia, or 8 feet towards Asia, sorry. If they moved 8 miles, we wouldn't be here right now. North America would have been swept in a 1,000-foot tsunami.
Well, 8 feet's a lot, too.
Yeah. But 8 feet is not enough ocean displacement to cause a 30-foot tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have either rise or fall or shifting of the ocean floor physically. It would create an 8-foot wave.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I were to ponder what might be able to do that, it would have to be, let's say, like a plasma beam weapon firing very rapidly.
It'd have to be very hot, and it'd have to be get deep into the ocean in order to create the steam bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you'd be in the H-bomb energy range, billions of tons of TNT all in a microsecond. So if you have some sort of craft that can emit that sort of energy, that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, that's way beyond our technology, according to what we're taught in universities.
Yeah. Well, it's quite possible. It is within the realm of our technology, but then you would, again, have to ask that question that we asked so many times the last couple of weeks, why Japan? And it, really, the answer to that makes a lot of sense if you consider what's going on out in space. And this is the, I find this, and I don't necessarily intend to drift away from this topic. You know, I want to come back to it. But I find it rather interesting that the more we bring it up, the more they bring up things that were out 30 and 40 years ago, as if they're re-educating us about the fiction of life out there in the universe, if you get my meaning.
Yeah.
So it's looking like it's something that's coming from space.
Right. Yeah, most people are at the kind of level about space that still think of the moon as made of green cheese, and you're just not taught that much.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
that would scoff at some sort of sabotage need to know that there have been other attempts on other nuclear facilities. In fact, Chernobyl very likely could have been a similar event, couldn't it have?
Yeah, well, I mentioned earlier, I've read the 9/11 ology website of a Russian named Dmitry Kalazov, and he says that all the people who were in the military and in Russia at the time, he was part of he was a cadet in the military with a Geiger counter during Chernobyl, measuring radiation levels around Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and you couldn't find any radiation there, supposedly downwind from Chernobyl. And the discussions in his class in university in Leningrad said that there's nothing in that nuclear reactor that can go bang like that. It's designed not to explode like a bomb. It will melt down, create hydrogen, which could cause some problems. But he writes that he believes that a tactical nuke was placed under the core, and it was powerful enough to blow the core of the Chernobyl reactor to pieces, projecting blowing off the lid of a 250-ton lid on the building and spreading carbon blocks and fuel rods in all directions around the facility. And so he actually says that there was no meltdown at all, because the explosion effectively shut down the chain reaction. And the fire department came seeing all these carbon blocks on fire on the neighboring buildings. And I got my ladders and got up in the building and put the fire out. But, of course, the carbon blocks with the uranium pellets inside them would have been extremely radioactive. Mm-hmm. And those 39 people are the people who died from that from that. And since there's no meltdown, and since the heat was dissipated within a week or so, and there would have been, of course, a release of iodine and 131, which has a half-lifetime of about 8 days, and that would have drifted with sound wind, but it's a heavy molecule. It doesn't go too far. Cesium also would have been created. Some other particulates would have gone in, but of course they're all heavy metals. They would have landed within, mainly within the parking lot in the complex, and maybe within a few miles of the explosion.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were relatively few deaths reported after that event initially, within the first couple of days, but then over time, we heard about a lot of people that were very sick from radiation exposure. Are you aware at all of any figures?
I've seen none in
terms of
1986 on that.
Mm-hmm.
Seen none. Okay. They were predicting millions of deaths due to radiation exposure. But most of the reports coming out were very, very questionable. The whole idea of putting what they call a sarcophagus around the building is needless. By the time that the Russian military came in, and then they put their teams in there for short durations to extract, to remove all the fuel spread throughout the area, find all contamination, scrape it up, and safely dispose of it but there's probably nothing left there to be radioactive. And so the sarcophagus was just a symbol of the symbol of futility. It's
just to make it look like they were really doing something to curtail, probably.
Yeah.
Window dressing, is that what we call it?
Yeah, window dressing, yeah. But according to Dmitry Kalazov, he knows who ordered the hit, and it was to do with Big Oil. There's a competition between the various energy, natural gas, oil, nuclear energy. They're all owned by the same people, but then there's competition between the various components.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really strange. The infighting within the group, it's allowed, but then the big boss over top of all of it, just watching it, and then chooses who the winner will be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very likely that some of the same people who are anti-nuclear and cause the Chernobyl problem or also behind the attack on Japan.
Well, it appears that way, I have to say, or at least it appears that somebody is in going that far with such an event. It seems like they could have accomplished that another way, but
I think that what they were planning did not happen at all.
Mm-hmm.
What they're trying to The tsunami wasn't big enough. The earthquake didn't cause the damage that they wanted, even though it was 9.0 and lasting 10 minutes. The Japanese built their houses to last. They're supposedly built to 8.2 or something, but they survived 9.0. Most of Tokyo is intact except for all the furniture being thrown around inside the buildings. No buildings fell down from what I read. There's lots of glass broken.
Yeah. Now, when you see the tsunami come in and sweep away these huge buildings, factories, houses, it leaves a real gut-wrenching feeling inside you, and you realize the power there. Evidently, the houses weren't built to withstand tsunamis. I'm not belittling it, but.
But wood frame structures, yeah.
Yeah. After going through the earthquakes, they were still standing. That was clear. Those buildings weren't damaged in any major way. There may have been things inside the homes that fell off of shelves or tables and crashed to the floor or got crushed by something that fell on top. But all in all, it looked like a pretty tranquil place until the water came in.
Yes.
And it had a serpentine motion to it, too. Now, one would have to assume that was the lay of the land, but the wall of water, as it was described to the people there in Japan, was so high that the protective wall they had against tsunamis didn't have any impact whatsoever in curtailing it and keeping it from rushing in. It was as though the wall wasn't there at all, I heard one man say. So,
well, the wall was 10. Well, it went three times the height of the wall.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how tall the wall was, but I can say once the water started coming in, the more it came inland, too, the more violent it got.
Yeah, well, so, it's carrying debris.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people in Thailand, when the water came in there, tried holding on to palm trees, but they got battered by debris and knocked unconscious and then swept out to sea. You have to get right out. You have to get totally free of the water to get away from the debris. You might be able to hold on in the face of a strong current in the water, but what it's carrying is what will hurt you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's obvious that that's a huge amount of water, and the force has got to be overwhelming for anyone to hold on. And I guess the reason we're talking about these characteristics of that is to understand a little bit anyway what might have caused that. They seem to be separate events. They seem to be somewhat out of sequence.
Yes.
Having occurred when an aftershock struck. And you say that they were happening about every 10 minutes. I know I looked at an active list, a real-time list of the earthquakes that were happening all over the world, and most of them were in the Ring of Fire region. I didn't really pay attention to a time sequence. I looked at the times, but I wasn't looking for that marker. So it's interesting that you saw that.
Some of the original artificial earthquakes, which started happening in 2008, with the first ones in the high Arctic, Canadian Arctic, there was 9 up there in a row, all at 10 kilometers deep,
mm-hmm.
all 4.7 on the Richter scale, and they actually created a circle and a square grid pattern, just like a bullseye type of, I guess they're testing their targeting action, and I believe that was some sort of energy beam weapon, which would pass through the atmosphere and deep into the earth and hit a layer 10 kilometers down, and then react. It's at the particular frequency that they would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And like all the earthquakes which happened in Sichuan, China, were all in that 4.7 to 5 Richter scale, and they're coming in like clockwork, and they're all at 10 kilometers deep. And then about a year after that, there was a series of earthquakes that were in the 5 to 5.5 Richter scale at 35 kilometers, and they're all 35 kilometers, and they're all impacting on the same, at the same level, with the same very spiky seismogram. It just looks like a heartbeat, blip blip, and mm-hmm. then no aftershocks.
Yeah, would you speculate that let's say if we're talking about a beam weapon, whether it was to initiate the tsunami or actually the any of the earthquakes, standing waves move through the ground. They move through the air and they travel long distances until basically something sort of eats them up, absorbs them. Mm-hmm. We have that that's a concern in a recording studio where you have low sounds, deep sounds coming out of the speakers, and depending on the amount of reflection and refraction and absorption that occurs in the room, if it's not dealt with properly, in other words, tuned to the frequencies that have that ability to move around, and rooms are all different. They resonate at different frequencies, or they're more susceptible to, let's say, having a problem dealing with certain frequencies. Say 20 hertz might be the frequency, or let's just say for sake of argument 20 hertz.
Yeah.
Now, if you haven't taken the precautions to capture that sound and inhibit any reflection or refraction, which basically allows the wave to return. They're so powerful that they come back toward the
listening wave.
Yeah. They can cause distortion in the room, literally cause things in the room to vibrate, which adds to noise. So you're hearing the music, you turn it up, the louder you turn it up, the more magnified the problem becomes. And in the sense of using that kind of weapon, speed would have to be important for it to be able to penetrate. Let's say velocity, because the percussive effect or the damaging effect of such a wave would come out of it being percussive in nature. We talked about that, I think, on the last two shows a little bit. Yeah.
A sound weapon, yeah.
Yeah, like a sound weapon, but it's at a frequency below the hearing range, for one thing. With all of the chaos that's going on, no one would even pay attention to that. They wouldn't be looking for that, or it would have happened so far away that they didn't hear it. But certainly they can feel it. That's the point I'm making about the standing waves. If it's that intensity that it can cause such a catastrophe to occur on the planet, I'm wondering if possibly that wave out of that weapon was actually even compressed. In other words, when it hits its target, when it hits the depth, based on the velocity that was assigned to its delivery, it has the ability to spread, proportionately.
Okay. So you're kind of like a wave front all converging at the same spot at the same time?
It could be that, or moving along with the wave. It could be initiated by the initial percussive attack when the beam actually strikes the water, or possibly strikes its target underneath the ocean.
Yes.
I'm just throwing it out there to see if that resonates with you at all, or
I've looked at things like that, and
no pun intended.
I can throwing it out there.
Resonating, you know.
Resonating, yeah. Okay. Like there's different. The Earth was ringing like a bell during the time period that we had like 1,000 earthquakes in the month of March, all off the coast of Japan, and all the 80% of them were unnatural, and some of them were tectonic movements caused by the artificial earthquakes, and natural aftershocks from all the energy that's been put in there, I just don't think it's a sound wave as you're saying. I still think it's like some sort of energy beam.
I'm not necessarily saying it's a sound wave per se, but something that has the capacity to morph in or cause an effect like a sound wave is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well,
because you would have to hear that. You know, I mean, the whole universe would be ringing.
Okay. Well, the whole Earth was ringing. The first time I heard about that term, the Earth ringing like a bell, was in 1964 with the Good Friday Alaska earthquake in Anchorage. And the Earth rang for a bell for a week or so. The sound waves can actually travel through the Earth in 30 minutes. The speed of sound through the Earth is very, very fast. Like a lot of the seismograms which I monitor are in Australia, and the earthquakes signal travels from Japan to Australia in about 10 minutes, be a little bit longer to the States. And if you have multiple earthquakes all happening within a 10-minute range, then it builds up a standing wave, and the seismograms are just look like they are a standing wave. They're just a continuous noise, just like, you know, with all sorts of distortions and overtones and humps and peaks and I believe that it's one of the things that they are trying to get was a standing wave action within the Earth from the multiple attacks in one or more places around the Earth in rapid sequence. But they did not, even with all the effort they put in, and with 1,500 earthquakes, maybe 2,000 earthquakes now off the coast of Japan, they have only had the 9.0 of tectonic shifting, which you're looking for. And they're searching all over the ocean floor. As I said earlier, it's like the patterns, like a meat tenderizer block, you know, the little pyramid spikes on it. It's like they've been hitting every single spot they can off the coast of Japan for up to 200 miles out, for the 400 miles length of Japan. It doesn't make any sense seismically, but they're hitting every single spot they can possibly think of, trying to provoke more tectonic shifting. They've gone to the point of setting up standing waves and ringing the Earth like a bell, and earthquakes have not popped off in other places around the planet, which is probably very, very perplexing to them, because there are huge tectonic pressures at all times in the planet, yet all their efforts in Japan have not caused the California to shift, even though they've also aimed their weapons at the Gulf of Mexico, or not the Gulf, or the Gulf of California, or the Sea of Cortez. And some of them are natural and some are unnatural. There's a lot of unnatural earthquakes are happening right on the Mexican border. Then there's unnatural earthquakes happening in the middle of Arkansas, parts of the New Madrid fault system, and they're pushing on that. But New Madrid isn't shifting. If New Madrid shifts, then you're going to lose St. Louis and Memphis, a lot of the Midwest there, and all the bridges across the Mississippi and dividing eastern states from the western states. And that appears to be if you're talking about sonic sine waves or resonating within the earth, creating a room of distortion. They have been very, very unsuccessful in being able to achieve what they want that way.
Yeah, I was using sound before as an example of how those waves move, but I wasn't implying that there was some guy up there with an alpine horn and a couple of singers singing Ricola. No, not exactly that image, but
yeah. And of course, yeah, I've looked at, I've told you before that I believe that scalar waves are sounds in going through the ether around the earth.
Permeating the ether?
Permeating, yeah.
Yeah.
And you can see the drumbeat patterns in clouds in the sky, the ripply clouds from scalar pattern.
Yeah, I've seen that many times. And
the speed of the propagation, that's the word, propagation.
Okay.
Of a scalar is actually very close to the speed of light. So that's where you get an overlap, a very subtle overlap, where the light frequency is directly connected to scalar effects.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the scalar effect is a longitudinal sound wave, and light is an electromagnetic waveform or particle form, depending on
the source. Applied. Yeah, yeah.
So, scale has been proven with Tesla coils. You create an electromagnetic distortion, and it generates etheric sound waves or a drum beat into the etheric.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been experimenting with that. So I believe that they've been using that as some sort of weapon against higher dimensional spacecraft coming in, or a way of locating higher dimensional spacecraft and disrupting their flight in the atmosphere.
Now, that could be actually, those could be pointed in two opposite directions too.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're firing up from the Earth at a craft in space, is it possible that the craft in space is aiming to fire something at you?
Yes.
On the Earth? Of course. And that could very well be what occurred.
Yeah.
Based on what I've been told has been happening since August 25th of 2009. And that was sort of a ramping up of hostilities out in space. You know, the evidence keeps coming in that this has more to do with what's going on than anything else. That's why I played It's a Shame at the top of the show.
Okay. Also going into the action of sound propagating actually through space, the etheric atmosphere merges with the etheric atmosphere of the sun, somewhere about halfway to the moon, and that the etheric atmosphere around the Earth is pretty thick, and it's equivalent. I was told that it's equivalent to 32,000 psi at sea level, which is a lot higher than 14.5 pounds pressure at sea level of regular atmosphere, which is only 100 miles deep.
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, it's the etheric atmosphere goes out for thousands of miles and merges with the solar etheric atmosphere. And some of the effects that they see in coronal mass ejections and are actually sound waves traveling through the etheric atmosphere of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the negative effects of comets upon the Earth in past times were actually etheric sound waves. It's like a very comets is a very fast moving and it's coming from far out in the solar system and plunging towards the inner solar system depending on its orbit, and so it speeds up as it's coming in, and and its etheric bodies interact. And I believe that the etheric body around a comet is 100,000 miles across, even though most comets are only about 10 miles across at the core.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a shock wave of the particles coming off of the ice particles coming off the comet,
which produces the glare or the flare effect that we see. I mean, I'm being very elementary in that description, but what do you think happens, let's say, when someone shoots something from space, and I'm thinking distance at some point doesn't even become a matter when you're using, or a problem, when you're using this type of technology. What do you think happens to the natural universal energy grids that are around planets and traveling throughout the universe?
Disrupts them.
Do you think it pushes them out of the way, or does it alter them that they take on another characteristic? You know, if we were talking about just a life force that can manifest itself into the various aspects of nature, you know, it would probably make the planet look dull, I would guess, which is how this planet is described from out in space now. But go ahead, comment on it if you would.
Well, there are energy bands feeding energy from the higher dimensions into the third dimension. Actually, the energy which we receive as sunlight is energy transferred dimensionally from the core of the galaxy, and that energy from the core of the galaxy is stepped down from a higher dimension from the universe, and the universe is getting energy from outside the universe, and so it's a tree of life. A life stream of multidimensional particles coming from one source, feeding energy in and inflating creation.
Yes.
So there are grids throughout space supporting the whole life structure on Earth, and the parasitic action there are beings out there who have reversed their consciousness towards source and therefore have to feed off of their brothers and sisters who are still connected to source through natural processes. And so they're siphoning off energy.
Sounds cannibalistic the way you say
it. It is totally cannibalistic. It's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But they're caught up in that and they don't know how to reverse their consciousness back to source. Of course, they are the prodigal sons and daughters of creation, and God has set up a system for creating the feast of remembrance and having them return to being full sons and daughters in creation, but they keep on turning the face away from source and stealing from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, usually from a lower dimension.
Mm-hmm. On my show last Tuesday, I talked about some of the anomalies of what they've been telling us about space. I don't know if you got to hear that show, but I commented on a recent disclosure that a scientist had found a worm traveling, hitching a ride on a piece of meteorite, and that was the indicator that they believed they had discovered life elsewhere in the universe, intelligent life. and this was, I would say it was within the last 2 weeks that I read about this announcement, and I laughed. And then I was doing some research, and I came across, actually, I had someone send me this link to a NASA site where there is a recording made in mid-2004 of radio waves that were analyzed. They were taken to the University of Iowa, if I remember correctly, and an investigative team there put the actual sounds into Cool Edit, audio editor, and they manipulated the frequencies up an octave, and suddenly it took on a shape that was more recognizable. It still was very autotomic, if we can call it that. It sounded very synthesized because it was a scrambled signal, but it represented speech patterns.
Oh, wow.
And these were picked up in the region of Saturn. Now, I know firsthand who that would have been talking. And that was merely communication from the mothership to some of the other craft in the fleet. Simple. That was in 2004. So what has happened in the past 7 years? I wanted to ask you that question, that somehow those that can talk on radios throughout our solar system, and NASA finally picked up some of the frequencies and were able to record it and even analyze it a little bit. What happened that those people turned into worms hitchhiking rides on in 2011?
Radio emitting worms.
Rims or roots, right? Well, I don't know. I mean, do you see the insanity of what they're telling us? Do you see the disingenuous nature of the work that they do, the trillions that they spend, and that's the best they can come up with?
Well, the think tanks are not working very well. They haven't imagined, they're just repeating the same old thing that's repeated since 1947.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, even way before that, we've right. come to learn. But that's you're talking about the Roswell story. That's still getting the media attention. And they blow it off as fantasy. Mm-hmm. At least there was no swamp gas there. That's the great thing.
Yeah.
I didn't think there were many swamps in New Mexico anyway. So,
no, there aren't.
But
Rio Grande River doesn't have very much swamp there. It's mm-hmm. running down to Mexico.
Yeah, and then a few days ago, somebody sent me an email. It was traveling around. I had seen this a number of years ago when I was reading the Majestic documents on Ryan Wood's website. And they were talking about the FBI files. Suddenly now, here in 2011, the FBI is once again being held responsible for having lost documents or having been conducting, the whole operation of discovering ships and beings from other planets that had crashed in New Mexico. There were references in those documents, by the way, to crashes in the state of Missouri 6 years before. And that was referenced in the documents as the crash of 41 in southwest Missouri. And that was untrue. It wasn't in southwest Missouri. It was in, they claimed later that it was in Cape Girardeau, but I had investigated that case with Bruce Witteman from MUFON, Missouri, and we concluded that it was Jackson, Missouri, 15 miles or so to the north. And what was interesting, after I came to that conclusion, Ryan Wood said, oh, that's why the Jackson police are in the photographs. And he never told us that he had those photographs. So we got confirmation by his very comment. We got a lot of other confirmation besides that, right there on the site. But so we know they lie to us about these things. And somehow we expect them to start telling us the truth. And it's just not going to happen. So we have to determine these things ourselves. We're not trying to, create fear and get people all afraid again. We have to sort of have that Japanese Zen attitude of moving through the space without, banging into the doors and the walls and the countertops. Mm-hmm.
Gracefully.
Yes. The panic, they'll show us images of people fleeing the buildings. There aren't many places you can hide on your way down from, let's say, the 80th floor of a skyscraper, to get to ground level. There's a lot that can happen. So you're safest sitting where you are, or at least trying to get yourself someplace out of the line of sight of potential flying objects or fall.
Stay away from the glass.
Yes, glass. And if you have a ceiling fan spinning around, I wouldn't think you would want to sit right underneath that. You find a place and you sit down, and just by being calm, you could actually have some impact when you take everybody into consideration. But people generally are going to panic. You could actually minimize the amount of damage just by keeping your cool.
Yes.
We're nowhere near that level of consciousness, but we have that potential to do that. And freaking out doesn't help the situation. You put yourself easier in harm's way. And I guess I mention that because we're hearing all kinds of different stories. We're not really getting the truth. We've talked to people. People are getting radiation readings. Now, do we know if those readings are from this event? Or, here in the States, in fact, I think within 6 days of that event, they claimed they were picking up radiation as far away as Rhode Island. Now, I wonder if that...
More likely that came from Hanford than it came from Japan.
You think so?
Yeah. And also there was... There are problems with the Canadian CANDU reactors in Ontario, and Rhode Island would be downwind from those. They had problems on the Bruce Peninsula north of Toronto with a small leakage, and of course that would more likely affect the East Coast than Japan would have.
Mm-hmm. Well, some scientists or some naturopaths actually would say that a certain amount of radiation is essential. A certain amount, but certainly not what you get when there is a nuclear disaster of some sort.
Right. Normal background.
Mm-hmm.
Ken and I were talking about it, and he looked into the report of the iodine 131 in one water supply in one section of Tokyo, which is about 40 miles from the water,
mm-hmm.
Towards the mountains, and there was no other trace of iodine found on any other section of Tokyo, nor in the area between Tokyo and Fukushima, and. He believes that was spiked there and that it was artificially added, but it was very, very low levels. It was like somebody emptying one test tube of iodine into the whole water, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water. So it would be coming out in the parts per million or parts per billion. And of course, anytime you see iodine 131, because its lifetime is so short, half lifetime of 8 days, that it would have to have been recently created in a nuclear reaction or fusion byproduct or fission byproduct. And so also I saw a video a few days ago, which I have not been able to get back to. Shows a Japanese reporter walking towards the nuclear reactors in in the nomad or the evacuated area is walking towards the reactors with a Geiger counter in his hands. And the initial reading it showed at the start of the clip from about 3 or 4 kilometers away from the reactors was in the micro sieverides or micro sievers, which is 1/1,000,000th of a siever. A siever at one siever rate would be a very high dose, but he was 3 or 4 kilometers away. He was getting like 70 or 80 micro 1/1,000,000th of a siever.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a meltdown there, that whole area would be so contaminated, you'd be in many, many times higher. And he got within 2 kilometers and he got up to 200 micro sievers, which is still not that much above background radiation. But then he ended the report. He didn't go any further because of the high radiation, but he didn't say what the reading on his Geiger counter was. He might have been trying to cover or protect himself from repercussions back in the news office if he went against the sanctioned story of what's happening at the reactor.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple of videos out showing that general region. There's some small towns there that have been evacuated. This is what gets me. They evacuate the town, and then they go into a gymnasium, likely at a school, and there's 8 people. Out of the whole town, there's only 8 people in the gymnasium. So you have to ask yourself, where are all the rest of the people? Oh, they're in the other gymnasiums, I guess. So,
okay.
And they're showing images of a Geiger counter going off, and you hear the, you know, as they're showing you how devastating the radiation is. But it's so easy to edit a video like that.
Right.
You're not seeing the Geiger counter being held in the presence of the people who are being interviewed in the gymnasium.
Yeah.
So certainly, you would take the readings outside and hope that when you take them inside, that it's not going in the building. There's no point in being in there. But the point I'm making is that they carefully constructed this video to make it appear that this was a nuclear meltdown, that the people are disappointed, they're all upset, and out of the whole town, which they show images of the town, it's a ghost town, there's only 8 people who have made it into the gymnasium. So, you know, my gut tells me that it's just propaganda.
Right.
And
a friend sent me pictures of workers in paper paper suits with respirators on, working or clearing the roads of debris and metal around the reactor. They have... it's not like the full rubber suit. It's more like they're just wearing a paper suit. That wouldn't protect them very, very much. But they're working within 100 yards of the buildings that are broken up, clearing the roads.
Yeah, they. I remember hearing Glenn Beck on the radio talking about how... at the time, he reported 50. Later, the number I heard was 60 workers who knew they were going to die because of all the radiation, but they were saving their country. Now, I'm not belittling that if that's actually the case, but it's appearing that, especially in light of paper suits, well, I would think they deserve whatever they get in that regard. Don't they normally walk around sort of resembling astronauts in the process?
Well, you want heavier shielding.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, for alpha and beta particles, a paper suit will protect you. A respirator will prevent it from getting into the particles from getting in the lungs. But if you're getting hard gamma radiation, paper is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Even a regular decontamination or suit would not protect you from gamma radiation.
Was the radiation ever identified officially by anybody? What type?
They did not. They were saying there was reports about 2 weeks ago saying that they're getting neutron beams, and you need very, very special detectors to get neutron beams. Because a neutron coming off a fusion reaction flies out at the speed of light, and in 10 to minus 13 seconds, gives off a high energy particle and breaks into a proton and electron. And so how to detect these hydrogen atoms at any distance from those beams requires a very, very sophisticated sensor. But that's part of the story which I've been hearing about MOX fuel and the higher plutonium concentrations in reactor number 3 and contributing to the meltdown. And I think that's just a bunch of bull.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any plutonium anywhere near there except the bomb that they put in to blow the containment building to shrapnel.
Yeah, they're trying to imply that they were developing a nuclear weapon, and they had no nuclear program whatsoever.
No, Japan's very much against the development of nuclear weapons, having suffered Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, of course.
Now, it's interesting that a few years ago that the uranium that went into creating the big little boy and the bombs that fell on those two cities came from Uranium City in northern Saskatchewan. And the people who actually dug the uranium out were Indians, and the Northern Plains Cree. And they suffered huge health problems from exposure to yellowcake and other ores in the concentration cycle, and died of all sorts of different cancers. And way in the north of Canada, there's the people of Japan put a plaque dedicated to the remembrance of victims of the nuclear bomb in Canada, the Indians who mined the ore. So there's that city's now pretty well a ghost town itself, but there in the middle of that small town is this plaque from the city of Hiroshima.
Yeah, we hear a lot of stories like that from around the world over the years. They seem to have come out more recently, and even people who fought against each other have come back and met each other and apologized. But of course, those that started the war and those that profited from the war have never apologized to anyone, have they?
No.
No.
Sitting on their profits. Daddy Warbucks.
Yeah. Well, ZS, we're about out of time. I want to thank you for the update on what you're discerning has occurred and is occurring there in Japan. In closing, anything people should be watching for, or what would you recommend people do besides just use some common sense and stop listening to the mainstream media?
We've had people I know who are just really afraid, and they're demanding that the government tell them how much radiation. And actually, the Health Canada, on directions from the Prime Minister, turned off the Geiger counters on the west coast of Canada. So,
Was that to save energy or
save batteries? But it's just of course, you're getting reports of iodine, but it's more likely from Hanford than from Japan, because Hanford's been leaky since 1945. And
nobody's raised any kind of a stink about that in a main
way? Yeah, she actually, the woman who lives on Vancouver Island was setting out a petition to petition Ottawa to release the radiation results or measurements. And I sent her back saying there is no radiation. So that actually caused her double shock. I sent her the piece, which I had posted to educateyourself.org. And she had a hard time looking at it. She saw it was just one of those David Icke type things, in her words, that she has a hard time accepting. And conspiracy theory and reptilians who control the planet and that sort of stuff, which she dismisses. But she was in, because she's listening to the mainstream media and the supposed meltdown, she was very, very fearful. It took about 3 or 4 emails to settle her down and tell her that she's in no danger. But how many millions of people in the United States, especially on the West Coast, are actually in a state of fear, which is only feeding the parasites?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tenuous situation, because people are trying to get valuable or accurate information, and they're not getting any, and they're hearing the fear, the fear mongers basically aren't providing any valuable information. They're showing images and telling stories, but they're not required to any scientific standard, any genuine proof. And then, you know, you can fabricate that with the technology there is today. Anybody can draw a bar graph and make claims about what it means, what it represents, but that doesn't mean it's the truth.
No. Often those, what looks scientific has very little science in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the show. We were hoping to have Ken with us, but he was preoccupied. So hopefully the next show that you guys come on, we can get into another roundtable discussion. Ken's gotten a lot of traffic to his website, where he's posted those archives from the shows that we did back in March. The end of last 3 weeks of March, actually, gotten a lot of hits on those. People are paying attention. I listened to one and read the transcript, and I was quite amazed at how clearly we were speaking about this. You know, we hadn't really prepared, and we were gathering.
Or the woman who did that was a very good editor.
Yes, yes. She took all the uhs, you know.
all the slips and syntax. And
well, it read very smoothly, but the point is that we touched upon a lot of things, because there's a spiritual aspect to this that we've been trying to get across to people, not to focus so much on the physical. It is important that people are safe, that people have a place to live, that they can eat, that they're healthy, and they're able to earn a living, and that they're happy. What is wrong with that? There are those that get or derive great pleasure from making others miserable. The big question is, how much longer can this go on? So
not much.
Not much.
Not much longer.
The scale's got to tip in the opposite direction for sure. There's nowhere else for it to go. You know, it's like the teeter-totter. The evil ones are sitting on the bottom rung, or the bottom end of the teeter-totter. There's no further down they can go. So it's got to come back the other way.
Yes.
And that's part of what we're experiencing. Well, thank you, ZS. Folks, if you want to read his essays, go to Ken Adachi's website, educate-yourself.org. and look for Z.S. Livingstone. If you click on current news, that gets you rolling. But if you want to go straight to his articles, he's on the fourth line, I think, yes, two or three links from the left at the top of Ken's webpage. So, Z.S., thank you.
Thank you.
And I wish you a good evening.
Good night.
All right, folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. And tonight's guest, Zuranova star Z.S. Livingstone. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network. Over at BBS Radio, we had Seth Hendrick on the sound. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us tomorrow evening when our special guest will be scientist and inventor Jim Murray. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.